Hi, this is Mark Iverson, owner and founder of Ida History, a Boise area small business devoted to historical tours and content. And lately, I've had a question based on a term that I've heard thrown around the political arena in the news perhaps too often, and that is real Americans and the real America. To me, America is a place full of diversity in thought, religious belief, culture, history, and political views. To claim that you are a real American and you comprise a real America is to say you possess something, possess a nation built on how you are and what you perceive to be right. And of course, to me, that is relative to who you are and where you come from. And so I wanted to talk to Americans, great many Americans, Americans from all walks of life, all colors, sexual orientations, genders, religions, and etc., and see what they think a real American is, or if there is a real American. And I want to get their experiences down in conversations recorded, because when you get a person's experience, you understand them a little bit more. And thus, you empathize with their situation and their reality in America. And so, join me. This is the Ida History Conversations Podcast. Thanks to the Trendy Dads for that great piece of music to cover of the B-52's Private Idaho.
All right. Hi, everybody. This is Mark with Ida History and Conversations. And here's the thing. I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to politics and like authoritarianism lately, but here in Idaho, we got the House Bill 710, which is a iteration of some other fucking House bill, and then another one called 666. And it's funny, right? I don't know if that was intentional. But anyway, so that kind of restricts, they say, which is actual, like, a de facto ban of books that happen to have a lot to do with, you know, the LGBTQ plus community and critical race theory, as they call it. I call it history. But anyway, what do I know? I'm just a historian. So anyway, I am here with, why don't you guys introduce yourself so I don't screw it up?
Hi, I'm Molly Noda. I'm a librarian.
Right, and you're part of a group, right?
An important. Yeah, and in my personal time, I volunteer with the Idaho Library Association. I am the co-chair for the legislative committee.
Yeah, that sounds stressful. good for you. I like that you're there out there on the front lines. And my friend Chelsea, she introduced yourself.
Hi, Chelsea Major. I own an independent bookstore in Garden City called The Lit Room. Also, I'm a volunteer coordinator for the Meridian Library Alliance, and we run a banned book club where we read the spicy books in Idaho.
Right. Keep it spicy. Anyway, so we're here to have a conversation, as the title of the podcast kind of implies. But, or not even implies, it just says it.
It does.
Yeah,
that's
correct. It's pretty explicit. But anyway, so I'm going to be my dorky self, but we're going to talk about books and identity kind of in relation to America and the development of literature and history and how those, it's going to be a mishmash of great shit for you. So, being lovers of books, myself included, historians need books. How have books led to you to like becoming the people who you are today? That's a big question, but just jabber on about it, you know?
Yeah. So I guess I'll talk a little my history. My mom was an English teacher in Texas. She taught 7th grade advanced English for 20 years. And at the same time, I also was not allowed to read Harry Potter. So I kind of grew up in a very pro-book world, but at the same time restricted to what my parents would, quote-unquote, allow me to read. But grew up loving literature and then took a little, you know, ramble through corporate America before coming back to the literary world in the middle of a pandemic, decided I wanted to open a bookstore.
Well, was it because your mom not letting you read Harry Potter because J.K. Rowling said that Dumbledore was gay?
No, this is way before that. This was like when it was coming out.
A gay wizard's pretty cool in my book.
It's pretty good.
It's fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, and you have this book down across from Push and Pour. What's that place called?
Yeah, coffee shop, Push and Pour. They're phenomenal. We're also by Talia Wine in the Greenbelt area.
Lots of events, which is pretty cool. And I noticed that in this bookstore shop, there are all sorts of things that would be called, you know, critical race theory, which essentially, you know, to me, you know, it's important to have books that are critical of racial oppression. But Molly, you work for a library, if you're allowed to say which, I don't know.
I work for the Ada Community Library. I'm the community engagement librarian for the system.
Right. And so what was your journey to get to being a librarian and how did that identity form?
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in a pretty turbulent household. I didn't know a lot of people who had a family like mine. I didn't know anybody who had an Indian father and a white mother. I did know that my parents weren't that involved in my life. There was a lot of addiction, a lot of mental health struggles in my house. My dad left when I was 10. He went back to India. And I just always, like, I just knew that my home situation wasn't right. Like, I knew that it shouldn't be, like, as scary as it felt, you know, growing up. So I was adopted when I was 15. And then I just figured, you know what, like, I'm just going to get the most education that I can and try to get out of Idaho and try to run away and, like, never come back here again.
That worked out.
That really did work out. I came back. Yeah. Spoiler alert. I came back to, some pretty fun times. But I went to school back east and I really loved history and I majored in history. And again, I always was like, I don't know if I quite fit into, like, academia. I never knew where I fit in, right?
Right.
And I had a history liaison librarian, and she was just the coolest. And I was like, can I be you? But I didn't want to be, like, in any sort of ivory tower. I really wanted to bring, like, I remember what it was like growing up and feeling like, you know, am I worthy of this, but, like, how can I prove myself? And it was always like knowledge. It was always books and education.
Right.
And so I've always felt very safe in public libraries. And
right,
that's where I landed, was as a public librarian.
Right. And no matter who you are, you know, there's something that's going to represent you in a library. And then and that's the core thing. And that's what this bill, you know, for me, it goes after much more than, you know, anything else. It's almost like the soul of a group, you know?
I think the thing about a library that really drew me to it is I think it's like one of the only, I think it's the only occupation that's title is based on a building.
Right.
Which I always thought was really cool. And I think there is such a safety in, like, I don't see myself exactly in every book, but I'm surrounded by people who are, I'm surrounded by the feeling that anybody can come in, that anybody can see themselves, that anybody can sort of feel like brand new. You kind of leave a bookstore like this one or a library and you feel completely brand new and excited. Yeah,
right. I do. I feel that way. Like, it's like, because a book to me, I don't know. I don't understand people who are homophobic or transphobic or something like that, because there is a book to explain it. And I think, like, there's science to explain it and there are experiences to explain it. And I think that's what people that, you know, are misinformed about the LGBTQ, I need a quicker word, the queer community, and their experiences. I think that's what the bigots are afraid of, is they're afraid of people educating themselves. And, you know, I didn't understand transness, and so I wanted to have my identity improved, in my opinion. And so I went to the science, and I read articles, and I listened to interviews, and that's what a library offers. It's like a way to change your perspective and become a better person, you know, and freedom.
Well, I remember when I was a little kid, right? My mom was a teacher, so, I mean, we did okay, but we didn't have an indie bookstore. We had a public library, and she would take me to the public library. It was maybe 4 blocks from her house. I'd, you know, walk up, and I'd pack as many books as I could in my hands. And I remember there's some books that she was like, no, you can't have that book. And I was like, fine, thanks, Mom. I understand. Like, you're my mom, and I'll listen to you. Mm-hmm. Mostly, I was a pretty good kid. And that was the getaway from a weird, traumatic, like, personal family experience, right? Like, my father was not the best guy. We had a lot of, like, turbulence at the household, like you said. And the library was that place where I could come, I could be expanded to other perspectives, but I also just had that safe space that for me was critical to me feeling like I belonged, like I mattered, and that I had this capacity to access information and knowledge and stories.
Nobody's looking at you, but no. Like, I feel like held.
Yeah.
Almost.
We went every week. We went every single week on Tuesdays, and I would always bring back my books. The library is for the nicest people, and it was the best.
Yeah, my mom would take me to the library every Saturday pretty much, and I was so excited. You know, it was before all this, you know, access that my kids have to everything, so they don't ever make a choice, you know, on the old television tube. But like, they still love libraries. They love to go and explore the physical copies of the books. It's like a record store is now in again, because people are tired of just pressing a button on the computer. Like, and that's how I was. I'd go and like look for, there's a guy named Bill Peet, and he was an author, children's author, best drawings. I'd get so excited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, you know, as I got into Indiana Jones, you know, I wanted to learn about places that he traveled to, right? And then, you know, and then I met people that are, you know, they were from all sorts of different walks of life and different, you know, black people, gay people, you know, like, you know, Thai food. We love Thai food, and we met like the best Thai people and like best food ever. And I wanted to know about these people, and I went to the library.
Well, and if you couldn't travel, right, you could travel via book. You could rent. I knew we could get like VHSs from the library.
Yeah, it's all about access, and I know that that can be very frightening for some people. And I'm not here to like, I think through this whole like legislative session, I've just tried to understand, like, my job is a lot. It's a lot about empathizing, and it's very hard to empathize, but I have to try to understand where some of these identity politics have originated, how they fuel people and movements, and why it's something that is, some people are so afraid of. They're so afraid of books.
Yeah, and I think you're getting at the heart of it too, is I grew up in a pretty conservative household, conservative area in Texas, and a lot of it was fear-based, right? It was othering. It was something is different, so therefore it is wrong, right? And instead of asking, well, what's interesting, or can we be curious about it? Can we learn something from it? It was, we're going to fence it off. We're going to close the doors. We're going to either not talk about it, or we're going to judge it.
Well, and if you want to talk about the power of a book to form identities, you look to the Bible. People can become great people from learning about Jesus and his teachings. But then you get like the fire and brimstone crowd, and then you get the, you know, like Martin Luther King, let's help humanity. But then I learned that, you know, like the Black Baptist movement also did not, you know, I'm generalizing here, but based on that, they oppressed, you know, the queer community and didn't work with the queer community. Not all of them. Some of them did. Like, it's very, but like, that's a very powerful book. And I grew up around people that were very kind of like discriminatory based on the Bible. I'm like, if this is about love, why are you saying horrible things about these people, even if you disagree with them? Right. And I just, but so I went the opposite way. I'm like, fuck that. And I went, all in my parents, a lot. My dad had, I mean, you know, what's the book you have up there? Native Son, Richard Wright. You know, he had James Baldwin on there. And I read The Fire Next Time. And then because of that, I was like, I read Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, and his books because, well, I wanted to know, they called him the modern James Baldwin. And that should challenge me. And some of that stuff I didn't want to admit, you know, but then I was like, well, I thought about it. And like, so again, books fashioning me into a better, more empathetic, caring person that wants to understand a great deal about different people, because I don't like seeing people be treated poorly. And when you get to know them as individuals, because you read those books.
But what you're pointing out, Mark, is that you put yourself in a place where you were willing to be uncomfortable. You were willing to look at your privilege. You were willing to stretch yourself. And I think where we are at right now is that if it even exists, it's offensive to me. I have the right to not be offended.
Right.
And, you know, that is 100% against, like, librarians' ethics and booksellers' ethics.
Yes.
It's
on Idaho ethics, right?
It's, yeah, we are a state that values independence.
Great.
We want hands off. We want to exist on our own terms.
But that's changing. You get a lot of, like, you know, people are like, I don't like Californians for this reason. It's like, a lot of them say, Idahoans say it's because they're liberalized. And I'm like, no, that's not it. They're majority conservative and they're moving here. And that's how they're changing this with this identity politics. It's much different because this core history of Idaho is a more libertarian kind of, you know,
groundedness. I mean, I think there is also, you know, there's a history of Idaho really embracing states' rights that could also be translated to anybody who doesn't look like me needs to stay out. I think the messaging has changed. And I think there's a vocal minority who are very, very loud about how an Idahoan maybe looks a certain way. Idahoans who have grown up here for 30 years, they're so polite and kind and respectful. They may think it, but they're not going to act on it, and they're not going to tell you not to read about it.
We're okay.
100%. I would stand by that.
Right.
Actually, don't. No. Edit that out. No.
Oh, too bad. I'm too lazy to edit. But what? Okay, so you were talking about your personal experiences growing up, and it's just like, to me, that can be put into a book. Or, you know, there's great truth in fiction,
right?
That they, you know, like, yeah, I mean, some of my favorite authors put a lot of their personal experience into the fiction they write. And it's this saying, I'm going to restrict this book, you know, or somebody saying that is, if I was to look in you in the face or you in the face and say, I don't believe that's true. And I don't think that is, you know, like, why are you making me feel guilty? You know, like, oh, what are you? And it's like, no, it's not about feeling guilty. It's about learning about somebody's experience. So I might as well just be like saying, spitting in your face, because that's what they're doing. It's just passive aggressive because they can do it from afar. You know, they don't have to look you in the face and say, I don't value your story. You know, that just your face is contorting.
Well, I'm just thinking too, right? It's easy to think of it like a us versus them scenario.
I do.
And I do think that obviously we are all pro-library here, and I'll just restate that. We're pro-book and pro-community. But I also think like there's people on the end of the spectrum who come into the bookstore and are like, what's a book ban? And so strangely enough, I feel like there's still a ton of education to be done around what's actually happening, because as we know, government and systems of oppression, dare I say, are complicated and often not made simplified and not made transparent to the normal average American who's working their 9 to 5 trying to make ends meet, right?
Right.
So it's like, how do we also communicate the message of, hey, it's okay that you haven't been paying attention. Maybe you've had your own things going on, because it's honestly, right? It's a place of access and privilege for me to know what's going on and to be able to have time to communicate that. So I also think about the other end of the spectrum, which is people hear, oh, there's porn in books. And so obviously it's like yelling fire in a theater. We're going to have panic. No, we don't want that. That sounds bad. But instead I try to bring it back to, okay, well, like, what don't you know? How can we start with like a conversation around education first? Now, obviously certain things have been passed. We were there. That's happened. But I also think about that.
July, if it comes effective July 1st.
Yeah.
Well, see, you look at those people and you say that. My shortcoming, and I'll the shortcoming is I see like people, and you're talking about like, you know, oh my God, it's porn, and I just see, I hear this, bah, you know, bah, you know, I see sheep, and I'm like, yeah, fuck that, and that's my shortcoming, because when I do talk to people and I slow down,
yeah,
I find that I don't feel that,
yeah,
but like right off the bat,
nice. I think like American, the way we communicate now, I do think that like we, what's the book that we both love? On Earth, We're Briefly.
Oh, yeah. On Earth, Ocean Vuong.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. He's right over there. He talks about like the violence of American language and the violence in which the way we communicate. And
mm-hmm.
that is something I also really noticed as of late, is that, yeah, it's, we are so afraid that our rights are being infringed upon on both sides of this issue.
Yeah.
That it's very difficult to feel like we can actually communicate. And that's not a new idea. Like, I think civil discourse has been waning for quite a long time.
Oh, yeah, we need some.
But I mean, I also think that's why libraries really try to foster that. And I do think that's why we can see, I think we've been called unrelenting.
Yeah. And I mean, I think for me, one of the things is like, okay, well, people get overwhelmed by the system. They get overwhelmed by what's going on. So it's like, how can we encourage people to not give up, not lose the faith, to keep participating? Idaho primaries are coming up, people. Right. Like, there's things actively happening, you know, in the next month. So, you know, stay tuned.
I mean, even taking a look at the books that have been challenged in Idaho, some of them, I believe there's a substantial number, there's no sexual or LGBTQ content in them.
But then you get the yeah, but people, and they're like, oh, we found this like pornography. And like, well, at one of the hearings, the woman had like a bunch of, you know, pages marked. Right. And it's all relative. It's all subjective. It's all like, right. But people are like, oh, look at that book. It's got a lot of.
Right.
Yeah. But I don't know if. I'm sitting here talking about identity politics and forming of identity. I don't know if everybody thinks that way about it. I think you're actually like, I think you're right in the sense that it's very much like, oh God, they just like snap. I'm afraid. And I do that too.
Yeah. I do too.
But it's like more about them. Like I otherize the people that I feel are coming after other people.
Right.
You know, and in some sense they are, but
yeah, I think I just got an email for a webinar for librarians, and I think I just mentioned it, but it said, like, I have the right to not be offended. I have the right to not look at it. And I think that is, like, the crux of the issue, that some people believe that, and that I don't. I also think there's a lack of education about, like, what libraries do and
for sure
what we stand for, and I think it angers some people.
Well, like the Meridian Library, for instance, and I probably other ones, they have these business contracts templates that you can get for free.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's huge for me because I don't want
right. They have a full digital brand,
right?
Right? Right. It isn't about just books. It's about actually being able to use the podcast like tools. You can use 3D printing.
Right.
Right? Like you can access the computers. Like there's services that are, you know, available for small business like owners, which as myself, a small business owner, I've used the conference rooms, right?
And they got great history books like downtown
Boise,
the Idaho room. They took that out of like being isolated and they put it out in the common stacks. And I have access to all this information that I never had before because they did that. And I go up there and I've dorked out with several librarians that are like, oh, can you believe it? Like only true history nerds can. And I'm like, oh, they have maps, they have geological surveys. You know, it's like, oh, yes, they do. And we just nerd out and it's fun and I feel better. I've had conversations with people. A guy was, you know, has a Mexican ancestry. And we started talking about, you know, the history of Mexico. And he talks about his identity coming to Los Angeles and then Boise. And I mean, those are conversations that libraries inspired, you know, and I'm a different, better person because of it. But I did want to ask, though, this is a great conversation, but what do you guys feel? What's kind of important about literature in the history of the United States? Like, how has it formed us as a country? If you guys have certain works that really like stick out in your mind that have progressed this country or perhaps hindered our development and led to great, you know, like the power of a book. Like I'm going to say it, people are going to be like, oh my God, you can't, Mein Kampf. That one book sure fucked up the world a lot, right? The power of a book. But what's the reverse? What's an American context?
And I will just say that, like, if someone comes into our library and asks for that book, we will do everything that we can to try to locate it for them.
Right. Scholars should be able to see it, too. I you know.
Yeah. Okay. I would definitely say probably the one book that really, like, shook me to my core, and I think that has really shaped a lot of our understanding of history is The Bluest Eye, Toni Morrison.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah. Oh, yeah. I just read that. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, wow. I think just so many elements of that. I mean, I'm going to totally just like give the layman's version of this. I'm sure there's thousands of historians and critics and literary criticisms on this work. I mean, I think just the power of the narrative of really taking you in the inside of like how insidious and destructive the legacy of slavery and racism, how it never really quite leaves you.
Right. And that's why it's such a work of genius. It takes place, what, in the, it goes back in time, but it's not actually set during like the 1860s and pre-Civil War.
Right.
You know, it's set in the 40s.
Yeah. Right? I think it's in Ohio.
Ohio, right.
And then I think that's where Toni Morrison grew up. And it's fascinating and horrific because, you know, the main character is really coveting having white facial features. And
right.
So the promise of not being African American, you can see actually that she has no other recourse other than to really suffer horribly. And she's not enslaved, but she might as well be, right?
Well, and you know, you people who understand or are somewhat knowledgeable on the history of, you know, like minstrel shows and blackface performances know that these stereotypes based on color, based on, you know, the your facial features.
Right.
They applied stereotypes to these and characteristics that weren't real. You know, in the 1830s, Jim Crow, right? That's where it comes from.
Right.
Character. And then that we believe these. So it's not to make you, Toni Morrison's not writing that to make you feel guilty, white person. You know, she's doing that to say this is a very real fucking thing. And I mean, I'm not going to say everything she did it for, but I learned a lot from that book.
Well, and there's interviews, right? You want to learn more, like Toni Morrison has plenty of captured interviews and recordings.
And you can't not research after that book because you realize how little you know about everything, right?
Right.
It just blew up my entire world. I read that in a trailer with my husband.
Oh, nice.
We went up into the desert and he went and biked and I hung out with my old dog and read.
And
he came back and I was like sobbing. I'm like, I finished it in a day. I don't recommend it.
We call a light read.
I'm going to hide over there in Clay Street to bungalows or whatever.
34th and Klein.
Yeah. I was up in the hot tub on the far end, and I was like, Michaela, my wife, one of my favorite memories is she was reading a Jane Austen novel in Bulgaria, and I was reading Schindler's Ark by Thomas Keneally, which is one of my favorite books in a very, you know, hard-hitting way, obviously. But there's a picture of us, our friends took of us. We'd been doing that for 8 hours. So we were so tired of being Peace Corps volunteers at that point that we just went to this nice hotel and we read these books. And so when we went there for our anniversary kind of celebration, she's reading a book, I'm reading a book, and I'm drinking some wine that, you know, Samantha from Snake River Winery, Wine Tours, recommended. So I'm like, oh, I know this is good wine. And I'm reading this, and I'm taking a picture, blew his eye. I think I sent it to you, and then I took a picture of your bookshop from over there. But now that is tied to my, like, one of my favorite moments in, you know, and with a book, with some wine, and creepily peering at your bookshop.
Well, do you remember where you were when you read it?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
I remember in middle school, I accidentally didn't return a book to the library. So sorry. No one's ever done that before. And you know, there was fines, though, at my library. So we had to pay. But I got the collective works of Langston Hughes.
Oh, nice.
And I feel like my mom did not know how to, like, have that dialogue with me because I was probably in seventh grade. And I am just reading this Black man's experience, and I had never really read anything from that perspective before. And it was just this eye-opening view of, holy hell, it's not simple. Right?
Wow.
And I remember, like, reading it in the closet, which is really weird, but, like the sense of, I don't feel like it's what people my age are reading. I was reading an advanced level for my age. So I was just like digesting everything I could get my hands on.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it was wonderful.
You knew you shouldn't be reading, right?
Yeah. I felt like I wasn't supposed to be reading this book. And I remember it was quite large. Like, it wasn't a subtle, small, tiny book. It was, like, you know, sizable, like 2 inches thick, you know.
That's a joke.
Anyway, all this to say is, you know, like, that exposure to something I hadn't read before.
Were you hiding it, like, from?
I definitely feel like I was, because I grew up in a very segregated town in Texas, even though, like, you know, this is the 90s. And I remember just thinking, like, this book has given me such a lens into the world that I had never seen before.
And it's interesting that you knew.
And I didn't want to give it back.
Okay. Right. And you knew that someone who loved you, your mom, might have taken issue with it.
And I think it was, again, like, not having the tools and resources on how to have a dialogue about it.
Oh, yeah. 1,000%. It's very difficult. And it's not, I mean, and that's what librarians encourage, like, talk with your kids. And some people are just like, you don't get to tell me what to talk about with my kids. Whereas we're like, just, if there's a reason why the book is not something that you think your child is ready for, that needs to be communicated.
Yeah,
that needs to be talked about. Like, is there subject matter that you feel your child is not ready for? Obviously, like, we don't give, like, teen books to 5-year-olds.
That's a huge misconception.
So I just, there's definitely, like, a nuanced thing happening here that I think, you know, 5 years ago, we would just be like, you know, there's some content in here. Maybe, like, read the book first and then talk with your child. Now it's like,
Well, there's resources, right? Like, even with the library tools you have today, you can, like, look at books, you can get details on them to help make those selections.
I think now,
and I mean, I don't think my mom had access to some of those things back then.
Right. And even now, I think we're just kind of like, here are the books. And you just have to kind of have very careful conversations now about what certain families want to read.
Well, you know, it's all an impossibility for these people, though, too. You know, I mean, fact of the matter is, I know me, when I was in, my parents were like, when they found out what NWA was, because I was singing it in the back of a car, and your mom's like, what word is that? What? I'm like, well, a little white kid, I didn't know I couldn't say that, and I didn't know anything. because that was back in the 90s, mm-hmm. where in Seattle, they're like, we see no race. You know, blend together. You know, that was that. And so it's like, I went right into Ice Cube and Public Enemy and NWA and Cypress Hill. I didn't know what a bong was, but I was singing hits from the bottom, you know. And anyway, but my parents were like, okay, well, we're not going to take it away from you now. And then that's what I used to learn.
Well, I think that's an interesting difference, right? That like making the choice to give your children that the flexibility to have those conversations versus saying, I'm not ready for it. I don't know how to navigate that. So we're just not going to do that.
Right. And that was right? the core thing. Like, you know, my friend, my other friend, he had very, you know, far right leaning religious parents. And, you know, my opinion here, and I'm cool with it, you know, because I'm right. Just kidding, folks. Just kidding, but not really. But anyway, she said she took my CDs, man. Uh-huh. She took my Cypress Hill CD, and she wouldn't give it back. And like, I was kind of pissed about that. But her kid is totally like close-minded, violent, and aggressive. You know, and I don't know, maybe it's just who he was, but they wouldn't talk about him, and they definitely stuck to very, like, you know, solid gender identities, and so he was belittled in many ways, and he became a very aggressive, violent guy, you know, totally yoked out, big truck. Just imagine the stereotype. And it's like, it just happens to be true. Like, that guy became the epitome of what his dad wanted him to be. And they closed off his, you know, access to information and other perspectives. And so he has narrow perspective, and he's very aggressive to people who have different perspectives, you know? So, yeah, I think, you know, you actually fashion a person much more by cutting off, you know, other access to information.
And then you can be like me, and because you don't get access, you then get more curious. So then you go find the things, right? Like, at the end of the day, I still read Harry Potter.
Right, because you wanted to, right? I know.
And it's quite good.
Yeah.
I rather enjoyed it.
It was easier to call me evil, though, because I had a Cypress Hill CD than once.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah, right. But anyway, I see your point.
But I think this is a really interesting conversation, because it's very clear that what is harmful to one family is so different to another. Right.
I was loud murder mysteries. I don't know. My mom was like, cool with that. She's like, yeah, very much like Queen of Suspense. Let's do it. Mary Higgins Clark. I don't know. You know, I think there was something there probably.
And that's her decision. Like, that's her right as your mom.
Yeah.
That's definitely not the government's right.
Right. It's complex. Right. And we had the conversation about I knew what I wasn't supposed to do or not supposed to have. Like, I knew the rules of my household.
Right.
And I mostly abided by them.
Yeah.
And later, I went on to get a liberal arts degree.
There you go.
See, I didn't, but...
That's all right.
But those for other reasons.
That's fair.
But now I think I'm a pretty good person. Other people definitely disagree with that, though. What are you shaking your head?
I know.
You're not shaking my head.
I know.
I'm just totally disagreeing, Mark. Wonderful human. Everyone should meet Mark.
I agree. And then pay me money to do tours.
Go on this tour.
Yeah.
It talks about the history.
Okay. So where do you think libraries are going these days? What is your hope for the future? Probably the worst time to ask that question. Yeah. Both of you. Yeah.
I was like, I'm going to step out.
Right. Chelsea's leaving, which is okay. But we saw Molly, and I was really asking Molly that question anyway, because he works at a library.
Okay. Where are we going? Well, I mean, at least, you know, I think libraries are... We've always been really innovative. We've always, like, changed with the times.
Right.
And I guess, are we talking in the context of, like, recently what's happened in specifically in Idaho?
Yeah, you know, and you could talk about what you think is going to happen. And you're going to have this divide, in my opinion, between liberal and conservative states. And you're going to have, I think this is just the canary in the coal mine moment, where you're going to have much more of this. And I'm wondering, like we were saying earlier, will the Idahoans who, like, maybe they won't read that themselves or teach their kids,
My neighbor said that he doesn't want his kids reading about, you know, trans people, you know, and their experiences, but that he doesn't want to cut off other people's access. It's too big of a consequence. And I agreed with it. I was like, yeah, well, I disagree and agree with you at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if that's going to win out or not, but libraries have to proceed anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think you can see in the testimony and in the headlines that librarians, Idaho librarians in regard to 710, there was just such a vagueness and a broadness with the law and figuring out how exactly would we implement this.
Mm-hmm.
I think moving forward, you know, time will tell. Time will definitely tell how the rubber will meet the road, so right. to speak. I think, though, we are such a resilient institution, and we have been, we're one of the founding, like, places that people went to, even in the beginning of the country, right? So I feel like we're going to keep doing what we're doing, which is obviously, like, we're about so much more than books. We're about community spaces. We're about lifelong learning. We're also about, you know, meeting people where they're at. So I go out to the state prison every few months. I help seniors pick
up. Oh, cool. You go out to the state prison. That's awesome.
I do. Yeah. It's, you know, I think we have a very, we're scrappy, right? We like,
right.
We make it happen. And library services, we're just going to try to our best to have them not be impacted. And I think we'll do what we do best, which is adapt.
Until, for what I understand, you know, this restricting of certain books is unconstitutional because you're trying to define it as lewd and it's not legally been ruled as obscene. So I don't know how this shit can stand. It's you know, that's my opinion is that, you know, I actually think that if you're a liberal person and you're in a blue state and you're trying to, like, you know, cut off access to whatever dumb book Bill O'Reilly's having next or, you know, like I said, Glenn Beck or anything that's conservative, I think that's wrong, too.
I think that did happen.
Right. And I think that should be
so mad. Bill O'Reilly,
right.
My book is banned.
Yeah, but he was like, it's not like this other shit that they're trying to promote, but my book? Well, because it was like killing Jesus. It's like people, he's talking about the Romans and obviously the Jewish authorities, like, going after Jesus. He's not talking about.
Yeah. There's something offensive for everyone in a library.
Right. And you,
right?
If you're going to ban something, then you might as well ban the other side of things because they're going to be coming at you. Right.
And the deal with this particular bill is that it's a forced relocation, which is
forced is the wrong fucking word in a free society, people.
And that's what Mark is saying, by the way.
Well,
Mark just said.
Well, yeah, it is. You're forcing somebody to move something.
Right. And this is also my day off, everybody.
Right.
I'm not working. So I think, but also like that visual, right, of like, here are some books. And, you know, we were told like, oh, you can just get a $25 shelf off of Facebook Marketplace and put it behind your desk.
Right. No. Go ahead.
That's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
I think the statement speaks for itself. Because also, what does that look like for a child from a mixed race family?
Right.
Which those books have been challenged in Idaho. There's no content that is obscene, quote unquote, in there. But guess what? It's harmful to one particular family.
Yeah, I know.
So it potentially could go in this adults only area, which what does that look like to a kid who's different?
Right. And here's the thing, like, I want to say to all those kids, and I think what the nefarious thing, the just poisonous thing of this fucking bill is that you're taking, yeah, and most predominantly with you know, in the queer community, you're already taking people that, you know, it's hard enough for me to come out and be who I am, you know, as just a heterosexual white dude that likes fucking Harry Potter. You know, it took me years, or maybe a good romantic comedy. I felt like, oh, that's not manly shit. You know, I had to become who I am.
it's doubly hard for somebody in a conservative state who maybe lives in a small town and is trying to figure out, like, oh, am I gay? And then trying to reckon with that as opposed to the rest of society, you know? Or, you know, like, so you're going to see this thing restricted, and that's not going to help. That's going to, it's somebody saying there's something wrong with you, therefore we have to restrict it so that our kids aren't tainted by who you are. And that is bullshit. Like, why do I have to be tainted by, you know, what's in the Bible? You know, very, very horrible shit in the Old Testament. Like, if you don't believe it, agree with that, that's fine. But the thing is, I don't want my kids reading about some of the stuff that actively talks about genocide in the Bible, right? It, you know what? That's my fucking opinion. You know, should I restrict that? That makes Christians seem lewd, right? And something wrong with Christians, right? But I know you can't paint with a general, you know, brush or canvas, whatever the hell you want to say. You know what I mean? That's my problem.
Yeah, I hear you. And I think that's, by and large, like, a majority of Idahoans feel the same way. And not in your wonderful language, of course, but they don't support this type of legislation. They don't think that there's a problem with their libraries. And I wanted, on a side note, a lot of the books that have come under fire, books on puberty, books on anybody who is trying to figure out how they're identifying, those books are often stolen from our libraries.
Really? Why? Because they secretly need them, or they don't want them there, so they steal them? Or...
You know, I've had some kids come back with their grown-ups, and their grown-ups are like, tell them what you took, and it could be a book that they didn't feel safe or comfortable checking out.
The greatest letdown of my life was sex education in fourth grade, the beginning of that. I'm like, oh yeah, you know, my friends and I, all the boys are like, yeah, it's sex education time. We're going to see some boobs or something like that. And it was like charts. And we're like, oh man, this is so boring. Like, I don't think it's quite as controversial and spicy as some people make it out to be. But some of it is.
But some of it is. And some of it is like, if there's a character in a book who you know, books are mirrors and they're windows. And when you're trying to figure out the difference between both, you really don't want a record of that if you are afraid of that, right?
Man, the only people I fear are book banners. Well, other people do, but, like, you know, that mindset.
I guess my point is, like, we know the things that get stolen, and we know that it will likely happen because someone really needs that book. Right?
I think you must hear a lot of people that are just speaking, you know, totally out of their ass. I think, you know, because you're in a library, you're actually there, you know, and that, I'm not just saying conservative people either. I mean, a great many people probably don't know anything about what they're talking about. And I know you can't say that because you're tied to, I'm saying.
Really, well, then. I think that, I think over the years, I've just seen, certain books that people really need, they'll find a way to get them. And we give people the benefit of the doubt too, you know. I think in relation to all of this legislation with 710, yeah, there is no pornography in our libraries.
Right.
It's just not true.
Because again, it has to be,
yeah.
I remember the Boise Bubble podcasters, right? They talked to them, I think, the head of the Meridian Library, and he was saying you can't constitutionally restrict things behind
sexual
access place,
the First
right?
Amendment of
right.
adults, and kids actually do have First Amendment rights.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the only material that has been deemed pornographic or obscene at the Supreme Court level, it has to, you know, speak to the prurient interest of someone, which means its main goal has to titillate, right? It has to be something like Hustler, something like pornography, something like Playboy. We don't have that material. We don't, because we also, if you look at the specific books that have been called into question, there's something called the Miller test, which, like, you have to take the book at its whole. You right. have to take the whole thing and see if it has literary, artistic, or scientific value. And what else did the books do?
Back in the day, you know, in a video store that we used to go to, if you wanted to access pornography, you had to go through usually like a special room that had like beads hanging down. Mm-hmm. Maybe the library could do that. Maybe it'll just like, we'll have a beaded section. And you can't go through the beads. You know, that's where the stuff your parents don't want you to see is. You know, is that where they're trying to move us? You know, because it doesn't seem they care about this Miller test. But that's just me being kind of annoyed and frustrated. I'm trying not to go to the whole cathartic, like, yeah, you know, just melting.
No, but for real, like, the bill is so vague, and we've asked sponsors, like, what does this mean? Like, what does this mean? Like, we checked IDs. Do we rope it off? And we've gotten a lot of non-answers.
Right, because, you know, Jaron Crane, a representative out of Nampa, he said something along the lines of, you know, you better accept this bill or you're going to get one of the first ones. That's a pretty authoritarian talk right there. But
it was Brett Crane, the chairman of state affairs, older brother.
Oh,
yeah.
Two Cranes.
There are two Cranes, yeah. So Brent Crane, Representative Crane, is chairman of the Idaho State Affairs Committee, where 710 and 384 originated. And he did say that on the, I think it was the House floor, that they better essentially get into line. Otherwise, something as bad as 666 could come back. I think, again, that statement speaks for itself, so I won't comment any further. But,
well, no, it's you know, if you look back at the most, you know, threatening moments that threaten our, you know, free society here in America, you know, the people that ban things, you know, they're like, freedom this, freedom that, they come closer to the great authoritarian powers in history than anybody else, you know? And you know, I'm watching documentaries about PBS, folks. So, you know, it's good. It's not lying about things. That's the news that's boring. So, you know, it's legit news. And there are people that are similar burning books in the Carolinas, you know, the Virginias. Places like that. And it's like people are calling Idaho the West's version of those places, right? And that scares the shit out of me. I want my kids to form the identities that books allowed me to be, you know, they helped me become the person that I am, right? And I want my kids to be able to go choose what books they read so that they can shape who they are.
Right.
You know? And yeah. I think that's in jeopardy. Libraries are a canvas in my, like, as a metaphor, where, you know, if you can't tell a person what they're going to paint,
right,
and what, you know, inspiration they're going to have, you know,
right.
To me, books are fuel. And I read a great deal of history, but fiction too, and lots of stuff on different types of Idahoans, belief systems, people that have lived and now are gone from Idaho,
yep,
you know, and I feel that I have a richer understanding of Idaho than many people do,
right?
Because I want to know, I want to learn, and it's like when you cut somebody off to access to those different sources of information, that's to me the most un-American thing, yeah, you can do. So this whole idea of a real American, you know, it's like the whole point of America to me is to say you're a real American is to say that that's the least American thing, because my America and your America, I'm sure, are very different,
yeah,
places than like what,
yeah,
a real American type person,
right,
that says that is.
I mean, I've thought about this a lot, like in my volunteer advocacy work. And this is me not as a librarian or an affiliation with ILA. This is me as like Molly, the person that this like need and just like desperation to reclaim these old American values. I do think that there's a lot of fear in that, and that there's so much like chasing of your own tail.
Right.
And there's no way, it's just, you're going to keep chasing and chasing. And if it's not libraries, then it's schools. If it's not schools, then it's private schools. If it's not private schools, then it's bookstores. And, you right. know.
Exactly. And that's where
I was. We've seen that in history time and time again. I know that you've seen that. I guess I'll end with this. Like, if we want to keep going, or we could stop.
I don't know.
I don't know. There are a lot of really cool librarians throughout history who have really, really fought against censorship and book banning. They also are big proponents of privacy. We are huge on protecting our patrons' privacy.
Right.
So 9/11, the Patriot Act, John Ashcroft signs a bill where all records need to become public to the government. I'm totally butchering this. I've looked at it many times.
But no, I get your drift on it.
Basically, what happened is the FBI walks into this library in Connecticut and says, hey, I have, I need these records now of all these patrons and what they've checked out. Give me the records of what they checked out. These librarians were like, no way are we going to do that. We're not going to just hand over everyone's information. This went all the way to court, and they became known as the Connecticut Four.
Okay.
And they were one of the first totally outspoken opponents of the Patriot Act, where the government was like, oh, we just need to protect our country. It's the war on terror. We just need to find the bad guys. Librarians are like, that sounds really suspicious. Like, you want us to give all of our patrons' privacy to you without any sort of like process or recourse.
Right.
There's no subpoena. There's no nothing.
Right.
They said no. They were completely vilified by the government. But they went down in history as, yeah, they're called the Connecticut Four.
Well, yeah, a lot of times people that stand up, you know, at the time of the crisis aren't seen as heroes. It takes a while to get to that.
Denigrated quite a bit.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think we're at a flare-up of authoritarianism again, because things are changing, you know? You're getting more rights, more people are trying to sit around the table, and we're talking just a little chunk of the table.
Right.
But you know, and I think this is like, this is, people are afraid.
Right, but yeah.
They're, so I just think that, like, that things will change. We've had the textbook wars back in the turn of the century, 1900s, you know, where
it swings, right?
It swings. There was really very little patriotism in schools prior to, you know, like, especially World War I, right? Then World War I flares up and you get the Pledge of Allegiance and the flag, because that, before that, you had a lot of the small ethnic communities, and they talked in German or, you know, Spanish or whatever. And then you had this great, you know, we're all American, this nationalization. To like unify against oppression and, you know, the Hun, as they called the Germans, right? And so when you're facing this authoritarianism in one sense, you're becoming more authoritarian. And I think like right now you have people that are very afraid, and they're circling their wagons, and they're like, this is how I see the world. You know, it's like, and I think we're at that one of those, like, what do you call them? And you know, there's the whole analogy of the fence. It's the fence post, right? This is one of those big key moments in American history where this is going on. Our ideals are being challenged.
Right.
By Americans.
Well, I think it's something that we all really take for granted, too. Like, our First Amendment rights, you know, we just are like, oh, yeah, we have those. I 100% think that they are being challenged, and I agree with you, Mark, and that it is kind of terrifying. The other great thing about all of this is that people are really activated. We have a very supportive community in Idaho, who a majority of Idahoans are not supportive of this, and people are getting active. They're volunteering at their library. They're running for board of trustee elections, and they're, yeah, again, looking at open primary, or the May primaries are coming up, and People are paying attention, you know.
Right. So several hundred people that listen to my episode, hopefully it'll grow. You know, we were at the peak before, you know, but, you know, I'm getting more listeners slowly. Support your librarians, you know, support your libraries with the Idaho Library Alliance, right?
The Idaho Library Association.
Association. Yeah.
But same thing.
Yeah. Help them out. They represent everybody, you know, and they're on your side. So please support a librarian. Go hug a librarian. Unless they don't want you to, then don't do that. Okay. Thanks for tuning in, people. Next week, we'll talk about some more cool shit. All right.